Iran reiterates that it won't backtrack on its demand for lifting sanctions during negotiations with the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal. The UN Human Rights Office slams as extrajudicial execution the fatal shooting of a young Palestinian man by Israeli forces in occupied Al-Quds. And multiple explosions reportedly heard from inside of a U.S. base in Syria's Homs province near the border with Iraq. Appreciate you being with us. Well, Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister Ali Bagheri Khani says his country will not backtrack on its demand for lifting sanctions against the Iranian nation. Now, that's the demand Iran is pursuing in talks with the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal. The Iranian official says the U.S. was the party that left the deal in 2018, and therefore, it should take the first step. He was speaking to the Italian news agency ANSA. Bagheri Khani is also the top Iranian negotiator in the talks for the nuclear agreement. He spoke about the draft documents Tehran presented during the latest round of negotiations in Vienna this week. Now, Bagheri said the proposals are logical and well-founded and could be a basis for further talks. But Britain, France, and Germany, all parties to the nuclear deal, have expressed dismay over Iran's demands, saying they go against the terms of the accord. Iran rejects that. University professor and political analyst Mohammed Maradi says the European signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal expect Tehran to appease them.
The Europeans, basically what they're trying to do is that they're trying to force Iran to appease them. The fact is that the JCPOA was the compromise. There's no reason why Iran should compromise again. Mm-hmm. If every time the EU and the US puts more sanctions on Iran, does that mean that Iran has to go back to the negotiating table and then compromise again and again and again? What will be left for Iran if Iran makes such a foolish mistake? Even 1 year after Biden came to power, the United States and the Europeans are still implementing maximum pressure sanctions. Not with this administration, with the previous administration. This administration has only been around for a couple of months. So there's no reason for them to complain about anything that the Iranians have been doing. They are in violation of the deal. They left the deal. They tore up the deal. And they impose maximum pressure targeting innocent people, which is a crime against humanity. But they and their media behave as if Iran is somehow the country that is in violation. No, Iran was at the table, is at the table. Iran was committed to the deal. Even when Iran stopped implementing the deal, it was in accordance with provisions within the deal, Articles 26 and 36, which allowed Iran to stop implementation when the other side wasn't committing itself.
The fatal shooting of a young Palestinian man by Israeli forces in occupied Al-Quds on Saturday draws widespread condemnation from officials, the UN, and rights groups. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas says Mohammed Salima's killing is a continuation of Israeli aggression that should not be tolerated. Prime Minister Mohammed Shtayyeh slams the killing as a crime of execution. He says it should be added to an international criminal court file investigating Israeli war crimes. The UN Human Rights Office also says it was shocked by the, quote, extrajudicial execution.
Extrajudicial killings such as this are the consequences of the regular resort to lethal force by well-armed and well-protected Israeli military personnel against Palestinians, and the almost total lack of accountability for killings and injuries of Palestinians by Israeli forces.
Well, the UN Rights Office says Salima was injured and was on the ground when Israeli forces shot him twice and killed him. Israeli rights group B'Tselem also says the Palestinian man was summarily executed. Mohammed Salima, 25 years old, was shot dead following a retaliatory attack in occupied Al-Quds. Israeli police said he had tried to stab an officer after first wounding another man. Well, Palestinian detainee Khayat Fasfos finally walks out of an Israeli jail and returns home to his family after a prolonged hunger strike. He spent over 18 months in prison without a trial. Fasfos refused to eat for 131 days in protest. The 32-year-old ended his strike last month after Israel agreed to end his administrative detention. Facing widespread international criticism, the regime has also agreed to free several other Palestinians who've been on lengthy strikes. The United Nations has expressed concern about the lives of the hunger strikers. Israel uses administrative detention to lock up Palestinians without charge or trial indefinitely, but the practice is illegal under international law. Mona Candil in Ramallah says Khayat Fasfos was detained by Israel in October of last year and had been in prison prior to that several times before. Mona also gave us the details about the Palestinian man.
Last month, on the 23rd of November, the Israeli authorities decided to end the administrative detention of Khayat Fasfos. Only then he accepted to stop his hunger strike that continued for 131 days, as we have to remind the viewers that he was protesting his illegal detention without charge or trial, and he has been demanding to either release him or prosecute him. Khayat Fasfos was arrested by the Israeli forces in October 2020, and it was not the first time he was detained by the Israeli forces several times in the past. This time, after he got married and he had a girl, then he said he has the right to know why he was detained, why he's being kept behind bars without charge or trial. That's why he was protesting 131 days in a hunger strike.
Meanwhile, Palestinians in the blockaded Gaza Strip have marked the International Day of Disabled Persons amid Israel's blockade and harsh humanitarian conditions. The number of disabled Palestinians in Gaza has increased this year because of Israeli bombardment of civilian homes and infrastructure during the May war. Ashraf Shannon reports from Gaza.
Scores of disabled people and their families in the Gaza Strip came out to mark the International Day of Disabled Persons. They held a sit-in in front of the Ministry of Social Development to mark the annual international event. The Palestinian Non-Governmental Organizations Network, which organized the event, accused the Israeli regime of deliberately targeting civilians, including people with disabilities, during the recent war on the Gaza Strip. Last May, Israeli regime forces killed hundreds of innocent civilians, including women and children, during the wanton bombing of thousands of buildings in the blockaded enclave.
Tens of people became people with disability because of the Israeli offensive on the Gaza Strip. Also, four people with disability were killed in the last offensive. This year, we witnessed deterioration in the socio-economic conditions of people with disability because of the continuous illegal blockade imposed by Israel.
Currently, there are more than 50,000 disabled persons in the blockaded coastal enclave. Thousands of Palestinians in the impoverished territory became disabled during four Israeli wars since 2008. Scores more also suffered permanent disabilities during the 2018 Great March of Return peaceful rallies against Israeli occupation.
An Israeli sniper shot me while I was protesting peacefully during the Great March of Return in 2018, and I became disabled. I want the whole world to know that the Zionist regime is an illegitimate entity that occupies our land and doesn't understand the meaning of peace and only believe in violence and aggression.
During the last offensive, Israeli forces injured over 2,200 Palestinians, including 685 children and 480 women, some of whom may suffer a long-term disability.
The world community is standing silent for the crimes of Israel. All the time they attack the children, women, and this even disabled people, hospitals, schools. But the problem that the international community is keeping silent, and there is no actions, no measure taken against Israel, and to impose sanction or repression on Israel to stop its aggression against our people.
The Israeli blockade in place since 2007 has made it even worse for disabled Gazans who require rehabilitation and artificial limbs.
Experts say thousands of Palestinians in the besieged enclave have suffered from various disabilities in recent years due to Israel's use of internationally banned weapons against the civilian population. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
Moving on to Syria now, where multiple explosions have occurred inside a U.S. base in Al-Taf region in southern Syria. Local media say U.S. helicopters were seen flying over the area following the explosions. No further details are available, but unconfirmed reports say there were two blasts and they were caused by an attack. Back in October, the U.S. base in Syria's Al-Taf was also targeted in what American officials called a coordinated drone strike. That attack left no casualties. The U.S. keeps the base in Syria without any authorization from Damascus and has unilaterally declared a 55-kilometer deconfliction zone around the facility. Russia has issued a stern warning that Europe may return to the nightmare scenario of military confrontation. NATO's plans to deploy U.S. medium-range missiles near Russian borders and Ukraine's military buildup have fueled tensions. Russia hopes to prevent escalation through legally binding security guarantees, the draft of which is being prepared in Moscow. Marina Kortanova reports from the Russian capital.
The Russian leadership is extremely concerned about the possibility of large-scale hostilities in the eastern Ukraine, Donbas, and Crimea. There has not been such a level of military threat throughout Russia's modern history. NATO has dismissed Russia's proposal on zones of influence to somehow stabilize the situation. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has rejected a diplomatic dialogue, giving Ukraine carte blanche to withdraw from the Minsk agreements. The situation is more than ever close to a war. The United States has removed all diplomatic and political restrictions, while Ukraine's accession to the North Atlantic Alliance is a red line for Russia.
We are witnessing the expansionism of NATO led by the United States in the territories near Russian borders. That's why President Vladimir Putin is seeking legally binding security guarantees to prevent further destruction of the security system. If that does not work, our retaliatory measures will be harsh and the West will regret the missed opportunity for a deal with Russia.
Things appear to be heading toward a scenario of Russia's complete international isolation, in all-out technology and trade blockade, and an embargo on the purchase of oil and gas. To begin this plan, a military scenario might be implemented in Ukraine.
The NATO leadership understands that they have become weak and there is no unity inside. They need threats to maintain funding, and they create them by portraying Russia as an aggressor. That's why we do not hear a single word of condemnation from the West against Ukraine's escalation of violence in the East.
The Kremlin understands that passivity only makes things worse. The responsibility for the conflict will remain with Russia, and no one will be interested in the real picture.
It is unpleasant to negotiate with NATO and the U.S., and talks with Ukraine will not resolve anything because it is completely subordinate to Washington. Russia needs to remember one thing: the Anglo-Saxon respect only force. Russia must continue to strengthen its security and combat capabilities given the unacceptable policies of NATO and the U.S.
Russia demands legal guarantees since the West has not kept its promise that after the reunification of Germany, NATO would not expand eastward. Further advancement of Western forces and provocations will affect the fundamental security interests of Russia.
If Moscow's legitimate concerns about Ukraine and NATO are not taken into account, Russia will take retaliatory measures to correct the military strategic balance. An alternative to these could be long-term security guarantees on its Western borders. Marina Kortanova, Moscow.
Well, France's yellow vests have become a worldwide phenomenon, but they have repeatedly accused their own domestic media of refusing to cover their marches. Now, during their latest nationwide demonstration, a yellow vest group has targeted government media headquarters to accuse them of not fulfilling their duty to taxpayers. Ramin Mazahiri brings us more from from Paris.
If the yellow vests march, but the mainstream media doesn't cover it, does it have an effect? In the age of social media, the answer seems to be an unequivocal yes, perhaps much to the anger of so-called legacy media. Since the Yellow Vests started their season two, domestic media has been almost completely absent. But for the eighth consecutive Saturday, they marched nationwide, shut down toll booths, and occupied roundabouts. The Yellow Vests say they don't expect fair treatment from France's private media. Less than 10 billionaires control 90% of all the nation's media, with strict control over an editorial policy which many say is often right-wing. Starting in June 2019, France's mainstream media simply stopped reporting on the Yellow Vests. However, they continued to march nationwide in major numbers through the two-month general strike that winter and until March 2020, when the coronavirus forced a ban on all public demonstrations.
It seems the only thing which will get mainstream journalists to turn away from their oligarchical bosses is fear. Their reports aim to make the entire population afraid and to deny us our freedoms and human rights. But if we return to being hundreds of thousands or millions of yellow vests in the street, then maybe we can force them to finally switch sides.
In Paris, one of the yellow vest demonstrations gathered outside of government-owned Radio France's headquarters to denounce the failure of public media journalists to provide fair coverage of the nation's biggest social movement in decades.
We pay our taxes to support public media, and we pay to help privately owned media as well, but they both relay the exact same opinions and both exclude and they both slander any dissenting voices. What we're asking for is that the diversity of opinions be respected, and we're telling these journalists to stop their censorship and propaganda.
The ever-increasing concentration of French media ownership has forced the government to act. This week, they quietly authorized a commission to investigate the issue, with results due in early 2022. The conclusions will likely have a lot to say about the true freedom of the French press during the age of Western corporate domination. Rami Mazahiri, Paris.
And with that brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin. Thank you all so much for staying with us.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Oil and gas exports from the U.S. Gulf Coast have surged by nearly 600%, and fossil fuel production in the Permian Basin has grown by 135%, says Kenny Stencil, journalist, in an article titled, "Since Congress Lifted Crude Export Ban in 2015, U.S. has dropped climate bomb on world." Stay tuned for more. After Congress lifted a ban on crude exports in late 2015, oil and gas production in Permian Basin soared, while domestic consumption remained flat, leading to a massive build-out of pipelines and other infrastructure that culminated in the U.S., flooding global markets with fossil fuels at the expense of humanity in general and vulnerable U.S. Gulf Coast communities already overburdened by pollution in particular. That's the focus of the third chapter of the Permian Basin Climate Bomb, a six-part multimedia report by Oil Change International, Earthworks, and the Center for International Environmental Law. The latest installment released recently shows that the drilling and fracking boom that turned this area in the U.S. southwest to the world's single most prolific oil and gas field over the past decade was not driven by rising domestic demand, but by a surge in exports after 2015. Between 2015 and 2020, U.S. oil consumption actually declined by 7%. There was no corresponding decrease in extraction in New Mexico and Texas, however. Instead, fossil fuel production in Permian Basin increased by 135% during the same time period. That growth in output coincided with a simultaneous increase in oil and gas exports from the U.S. Gulf Coast, which skyrocketed by 589% from 2015 to 2020. Before December 2015, when sales were restricted to Canada, crude exports made up 5% of oil and gas production. By 2020, they reached 30%. According to the report, the export boom is not confined to crude. The author cites Matt Schatzman, a CEO of a liquefied natural gas LNG company, who said in 2019 that every incremental hydrocarbon produced in Permian Basin from this day forward, whether it's oil, liquids, or gas, needs to be exported. As the report notes, it is no coincidence that production growth in Permian Basin accelerated after crude oil export restrictions were lifted by Congress in late 2015. But repealing the ban was not enough on its own to trigger the twin booms of both production and exports in Permian and U.S. Gulf Coast. For the surge in exports and production to materialize, a vast network of pipelines, processing plants, storage tank farms, and export terminals had to be built, states the report, adding, "The build-out of pipelines in the last 5 years has been particularly intense." This infrastructure, the report points out, burdens communities with pollution and safety risks, and locks in a system of energy and chemical supply that the world can no longer sustain. In addition to the construction of over 12,000 miles of pipelines since the end of 2015, U.S. Gulf Coast export terminal capacity has increased more than threefold since the ban was lifted, the report says. Additional export capacity could lower the cost of and accelerate crude exports, which could lock in gas supply to countries that could be moving more quickly to renewable energy. In response to Permian oil and gas producers' plan to increase production by more than 50% from 2021 to 2030, the focus of second chapter of the report, Lauren Stockman, research co-director at Oil Change International, said that this must not happen. The third chapter of the report highlights several proposed export terminals facing community opposition, including the Seaport Oil Terminal, or SPOT, located near Surfside Beach, Texas, the Texas Gulf Link Terminal near Jones Creek, Texas, the Rio Grande LNG Terminal near Brownsville, Texas, and the Plaquemines LNG Terminal near Ironton, Louisiana. John Beard, a member of the Port Arthur Community Action Network, said in a statement that gas from Permian fuels The industrial beast of pollution in the Gulf Coast, especially in Port Arthur, Texas, my home. This boom has contributed to environmental degradation, significant loss of quality of life, non-attainment air quality, waterborne pollution, and diminished health for fence line community, Beard continued. Fracked Permian gas contributes to our significantly higher risk of cancer, heart, lung, and kidney disease, he added, noting that unmitigated greenhouse gas pollution will increase the frequency and intensity of hurricanes and catastrophic flooding. Beard said that Port Arthur and the entire U.S. Gulf Coast has become a sacrifice zone so America can feed its thirst for toxic fossil fuels. We can no longer afford to be the unwitting victim of this exploitation from the use of fracked Permian gas, he added. It needs to end now and utilize clean, green, renewable sources of energy in its instead. We say keep in the ground. The International Energy Agency recently reiterated its message that there is no need for investment in new fossil fuel production, adding that the extraction and burning of dirty energy must decline this decade while the worldwide generation of clean energy must accelerate immediately. Just before the start of COP26, meanwhile, the United Nations Environment Program lamented the fact that global fossil fuel use is projected to increase this decade, even as annual reductions in coal, oil, and gas production are necessary to avert the worst consequences of the climate crisis. According to an analysis released during the summit by Climate Action Tracker, the planet is currently on pace for 2.4 degrees Celsius of heating this century, unless countries, starting with the rich polluters most responsible for exacerbating extreme weather, rapidly and drastically slash greenhouse gas emissions, ramp up the transition to renewable energy, and enact transformative political economic changes.
Aperture. Welcome back, everyone. In the first part, we saw how in 1951, inhabitants of a French village were suddenly tormented by terrifying hallucinations. At least seven people died, dozens were taken to a local asylum, and hundreds were affected. Immediately, wild theories started emerging to explain this mysterious case of mass insanity. There were claims of poisoned flour, contaminated water, and even witchcraft. The truth was stranger than any of these theories. The Central Intelligence Agency had spiked the local food with LSD as part of a mind control experiment at the height of the Cold War. And with time, U.S. government's interest in LSD shifted from a defensive to an offensive orientation. While the initial experiments with LSD were fairly simple, if shockingly unethical, over time these LSD experiments grew increasingly elaborate. Stay with us as victims reveal the naked truth in the next part of this program.
Entire populations bore the consequence of large-scale tests. Here are some examples, again uncontested cases that are recognized by the American government. In 1953, radioactive iodine was injected into newborns and pregnant women at Iowa University and also in Nebraska. In 1955, the CIA sprayed whooping cough bacteria off the coast of Tampa. Two died and dozens fell ill. Also in 1955,
the CIA enlisted prostitutes in San Francisco, opened two brothels and tested drugs on the clients, then filmed through a one-way mirror. In 1956, the Army released millions of mosquitoes carrying yellow fever and dengue on the towns of Savannah and Avon. There were several deaths and hundreds of people infected. In 1960, in Cincinnati, the Army financed a radiation program on 90 destitute or ill inhabitants of the city's University Hospital. Some died after several weeks. In 1966, the Army tested a virus in the New York Metro, then in Chicago. The bacteria was concealed in electric bulbs. The aim was to study the spread of chemical agents on a large scale. For these experiments, the Army or the CIA funded laboratories in the most prestigious universities: Yale, Stanford, Harvard, or Columbia. They all took part, glorified by the idea of working for the nation's defense. The researchers went crazy.
Dr. Kligman in Philadelphia increases a dosage 468 times, which actually frightened Dow Chemical. They couldn't believe that a respected doctor would do that. In Washington, D.C., you had Walter Freeman, who was a very, very well-known lobotomist who traveled around the country doing lobotomies in his car. And he would use an ice pick. He could do 15 to 20 in a day. It was just incredible what some doctors did, and very few, if any, people in the hospital or the medical community blew the whistle on it. It really was an egregious act, and it showed that the medical community was more interested in protecting its ass than in protecting the test subject and the patients, because a lot of doctors went off the deep end and started doing things that are just inconceivable now.
To express his indignation, Alan Hornblum wrote half a dozen books. A former prison guard at Holmesburg in Pennsylvania, from his first day at work over 40 years ago, he had a horrible shock.
I was stunned to see scores of inmates with their shirts off, strapped and wrapped in bandages and gauze tape. And I couldn't imagine that I was going into an atmosphere that was that violent, because all of the men looked like they had just walked a cell block knife fight.
They explain that it's not because of any violence, but experiments that are carried out there. Alan was the first to denounce this scandal and would lose his job as a result.
It was probably the largest human experimentation factory in America, possibly the world. From 51 until 1974, more people were probably incorporated in more experiments than any other place in the world.
Drugs, viruses, cancerous cells, plutonium, sarin gas, the most toxic products were tested in Holmesburg, but also in dozens of prisons throughout the country. To condemn these experiments, Alan Hornblum found former inmates like Youssef. In 1961, this man was imprisoned for selling marijuana. He was poor, with limited education. He was offered a chance to take part in tests for a dollar a day. Since then, Youssef has had his digestive tract operated on. He has liver and skin problems and can no longer work. His first test was for a bath foam from the company Johnson & Johnson.
They took tape and they stuck it on your back and pulled it off, stuck it on and pulled it off until the first layer of skin came off your back. And they put six sections on my back like that. And then they took a bottle with the Johnson & Johnson bubble bath in it and put it on a patch and put the patch over the raw area. Then they took a can I recognized that can as being from the Army. And I was like, what Johnson Johnson got to do with this? So he took the can and he sprayed it on my back. And when it hit my back, it was cold. But it was so toxic and like fumes, I could taste it in my mouth. And as I'm walking down, I'm getting dizzier and dizzier, dizzier and dizzier. By the time I stepped into my cell, I passed out. Boom, and my back was inflamed. And by the time I woke up that morning, I had great big blisters on my back full of pus. This rash just gets worse and worse. And it looks like when the moon come out at night, it flames up. And I'll be moaning and crying. My cell partners couldn't sleep. Goes over there, a little shot cup, and it looked like water. We drinks it. Everything became magnified. The sound, like the loudspeaker on the system, ooh, ooh, ooh. The walls looked like they turned into water. You know what I mean? And like I spent the whole time like looking around like this here instead of doing the test. So I goes back to the block in that condition, and man, I mean, I was tripping. And it was like a slow-acting drug that was in that cup. It lasts for weeks. The inmates start naming me Outer Limits. I had no conversation for nobody. I was scared of the inmates, and the inmates act like they was afraid of me.
What you had were hundreds and hundreds of uneducated minorities, overwhelmingly black and Puerto Rican, and then you had white doctors with white lab coats with PhD or MD after their name, and it was a recipe for abuse, if not disaster. And those prison walls are an ideal spot to do controversial experiments, because just as those walls keep the inmates in, they also keep the public out, so no one finds out about it.
Prisoners were used, but also patients. In certain hospitals, patients were steered towards the services financed by the CIA. These services carried out limitless experiments on psychological manipulation. In 1965, Karen Wetmore was only 13 when she was admitted to a hospital in Vermont. She stayed there several times in her childhood. She suffered from severe depression after falling victim to a pedophile neighbor. Admitted against her will, she was not allowed any contact with her family, being told that it was for her own good.
The CIA was specifically looking for children between the ages of 13 and 18 to further dissociate. They wanted dissociative children. There's a sense of absolute and total helplessness. You're there, you're bound up, you're locked in this room. No matter how you scream, no matter what you say, no one is gonna come. It does something to you, something you don't get over.
The doctors went to work on Karen. They wanted to erase her memory and create a robot at their command. It took 30 years of legal battles for Karen to obtain her medical records and discover the violence of the treatments she was subjected to.
It says seclusion, full cam. A cam is a straitjacket. And ties, which means they tied my arms and they tied my feet. This goes on uninterrupted, day after day, week after week, February, March, April, right up until June 21st, 1971. You sleep on the floor. On the floor, no blanket, no nothing. And my arms were secured like this, behind my back. I do remember that. It's extremely painful because it pulls on your neck, pulls on your shoulder. You can't get away from it. It's maddening is what it is, maddening. And I was naked. And I think that was part of the effort of that experiment to break me down. Everything they did was to break me down.
Months in a confined room with no bearings,
while her captors administered all kinds of drugs, and sometimes electric shocks at inhuman levels.
Number of shocks and the seconds that they held the shocks. They had 30, 30, 35, 35, 35, and they held it for sustained for 40 seconds. A normal shock would be a second. Certainly not 30 and 35 of them. One, not that many, which probably is what obliterated my memory right there. And I think that's the way they did it. They also said, in this treatment right here, no seizure, shock restarted, so they gave me a second one. Because they couldn't produce a seizure. So they must have done it over again, must have repeated it. It's unforgivable. And I'm sure I wasn't the only one they did this to, I'm sure. I survived to be able to talk about it.
How many suffered similar experiments? In Montreal, Canada, the CIA used a world-renowned psychiatrist to set up a factory of guinea pigs in the Allen Memorial Psychiatric Department in McGill University. This psychiatrist was Ewan Cameron, one of the all-powerful presidents of the World Psychiatric Association. In 1945, Ewan Cameron made the acquaintance of Rudolf Hess, one of the Nazis accused in the Nuremberg trial. In 1957, the CIA recruited him for their MK-Ultra program. The Americans wanted to perfect their interrogation techniques and program a human to kill. Ewan Cameron became the mad dog of psychiatry. He put his patients in vegetative states for several weeks, while bombarding them with pre-recorded orders. Some would become incontinent, amnesiac, forgetting even who their parents were and how to speak. The Vermont hospital where Karen Wetmore was confined was working on the same program. In the hands of the CIA doctors, she was like a rag doll.
They used drugs like LSD. They used electric shock. They used chemical shock agent metrazole, which I was given in 1971, and I found that out in my medical records, which is a very brutal drug. CIA said it was excruciating, physically and emotionally, excruciating drug. I have a quote from the CIA that said that the Soviets used it in the gulags, and that a POW would say or do anything to avoid a second dose. Nice drug.
There's all kinds of people who believe and people who don't believe, and that's a debate about do you believe or don't believe. I'm always interested in what are in the documents saying. So the documents clearly describe implanting electrodes in people's brains, activating the electrode from a remote transmitter, and changing a person's behavior from angry, pounding the wall, sitting there just staring.
Behind Karen's ear is a scar, and she doesn't know what it's from.
Once my therapist really understood that I had really been experimented on by the CIA, she said to me, just for the heck of it, let me look. Because we'd read about, there's been information about these implants. And I'm like, okay. And it was there. I showed you. I went to a plastic surgeon who told me it was a surgical scar. But there's nothing in my medical history, nothing in a medical record that shows any kind of problem ever behind my right ear, or any incision or any surgery or anything else. But there it is.
What stopped the journey down this destructive path? In 1973, while Watergate is rattling all the institutions, Richard Helms, director of the CIA, feels the winds of change. He works as a lone wolf and hasn't informed the president of these experiments. He knows he's crossed the line. To protect himself, he orders the destruction of all documents relating to the MKUltra program and its abandonment. 2 years later in 1975, the President Gerald Ford orders an inquiry into the CIA. The Rockefeller Commission is sworn in. The task isn't simple, because at the heart of the CIA, even Richard Helms' close lieutenants know nothing about the brainwashing programs.
There's a lot of goofy things to go on in a big agency like that with all that secrecy. Things can go on that you don't know about, that the people who are working for the director most closely don't know about, or that the director doesn't know about. I mean, they're keeping it quiet down there. You don't tell anybody. If it works, then we'll tell them. But, you know, in the meantime, don't get into any difficulties. I remember when they wanted to take a kitty cat and stick a microphone up its rear end and put an antenna on its ear and have him walk in where we spy in the park with another one, walk over and walk around and listen in on it. You know, they tried it one time in an experiment, and a taxi came by and ran over the cat. You know, so.
In reality, nothing is funny. In its haste to get rid of evidence, the CIA forgets 20,000 documents. A drop of water compared to the amount that was destroyed, but they reveal that it financed 149 programs, implicating 80 institutions, including the most respected. Called on to justify themselves, the heads of the CIA, like Dr. Lashbrook, lie and downplay the facts.
There was, of course, claims or thoughts that maybe great things could be done with hypnosis. One small project in which we had a hypnotist do some experiments, primarily to see what the limitations of hypnosis might be. Can you make a person do something under hypnosis that he would not ordinarily do?
Even if the head of the CIA, Richard Helms, tried to minimize the scale of the experiments, the victims' testimonies contradict him.
The next thing I remember,
the inquiry commissions follow, each reaching more and more witnesses, like this woman, Chris DeNicola. Her father put her in the hands of a reputed CIA doctor, Dr. Green, when she was 12 years old.
His objective was to gain control of my mind and train me to be a spy assassin. Dr. Green had electrodes on my body, including my head. He used what looked like an overhead projector and repeatedly said he was burning different images into my brain while a red light flashed aimed at my forehead. In between each sequence, he used electric shock on my body and told me to go deeper and deeper, while repeating each image would go deeper into my brain and I would do whatever he told me to do. Dr. Green moved on to wanting me to kill dolls that looked like real children.
Inquiry reports that resulted from these terrifying testimonies revealed one thing for certain. The experiments ended in disaster. In its insane quest for a robot human or a truth serum, the CIA failed. On August 3rd, 1995, with the revelations mounting up, then-President Bill Clinton makes a public apology. Since then, a great number of secret archives have been released to the public domain. Researchers would take an interest in this troubled period, notably Hank Alberelli, who worked on the suspicious death of Frank Olson, the biochemist who worked at the heart of the CIA. Since 1951, the year of the Pont Saint-Esprit incident, Frank Olson called into question the ethics of the experiments being carried out and became depressed as a result. In November 1953, the CIA put LSD into his glass without him knowing. 9 days later, he threw himself off the 13th floor of a New York hotel. Murder or suicide, we'll never know. At the time of the investigation, Hank Alberelli found a surprising document coming from the White House. It surprisingly linked the name of Frank Olson to Pont Saint-Esprit. Why, in the middle of the Korean War, would the White House be interested in this small French village? Even better, Hank also came across a study carried out by the CIA on LSD.
the document itself was a comprehensive overview or history, if you will, of LSD specifically, yes. Not on ergot. It had nothing to do with ergot. There was a section or a chapter, if you will, headed incident at Pont Saint-Esprit. And the first two paragraphs of that describe essentially what we've all read, you know, many times over in terms of what happened at Pont Saint-Esprit. But the remainder of that section, the rest of that page, which was about half the page, and the two pages that followed, were completely blacked out.
Above all was this damning document from the CIA. It dates from 1953 and has no doubt been declassified by mistake. A director at Sandoz Laboratories confirmed to a secret agent that the Pont Saint-Esprit incident was caused by LSD. Sandoz Laboratories was where Albert Hoffman worked, the man who discovered LSD. It even claimed the drug was responsible for the Pont Saint-Esprit tragedy, before recanting. This same document states that in 1952, the source at the CIA had already explained that the cursed bread was caused by LSD. Did French authorities try to silence the affair? Several years after the drama, a head of the Victims Association was shocked at how disinterested the investigators were. Do the French have something to hide? We've interrogated former members of the Secret Services, investigated national and regional archives, as well as those from the police and the Justice Department. The files are hard to find, and many important pieces, such as reports from main hearings, have disappeared. If America revealed unwillingly some of its secrets about its participation in the poisoning, the uncertainties over the involvement of the French authorities may yet go on for some years longer. It takes 75 years for some sensitive documents to be made public. Hidden in its small streets and stone buildings, the Pont Saint-Esprit drama has yet to reveal all its secrets.
Judging from the CIA's dark and notorious past of misconduct, perhaps it'll be no surprise if horrific clandestine high-tech experiments are being carried out somewhere in the world by the CIA at this very moment. Secrets that we must wait 75 years to be declassified, if ever disclosed to the public at all. And that's everyone for this week on Aperture. It's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iransat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now, you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.